Hi, from Yale School of Public Health. She's going to talk about the impact of a chlamydia trachomatis diagnosis on sex partnership patterns and implications for ongoing transmission.
Okay, thanks, Patty.
Thank you. So I'd like to begin with a very brief statement about the public health importance of chlamydia. I don't think I need to spend a lot of time with this audience to make this point, but I do think it's important to remember that the number of diagnosed chlamydia infections has increased every year since reporting began. It continues to rise. In the last year for which we have data, 2010, there were over 1.3 million cases. And there's a lot of discussion and debate about the reasons for this and what's actually going on, but regardless of the underlying reasons for this trend, I think that the high burden of disease does necessitate that we understand what is the impact of all of these diagnoses. So one area that I've been very interested in is in repeat chlamydia infections, and this is a very busy slide. You don't have to look at everything. You can just look at that highlighted column. A variety of studies have looked at how frequent repeat chlamydia infections are, and you can see a range of estimates, none of which are trivial, and in fact, some are quite substantial. And sort of the best estimate we probably have is about 15 to 20% of women who get chlamydia will get it again within a year. So lots of repeat infections. So trying to understand the reasons for this, for the repeat infections and prevention of repeat infections, I think a lot of literature has looked at the impact of a diagnosis on individual partnerships. So when someone finds out they have chlamydia, what happens in their relationship? Do they continue the relationship? Do they end the relationship? Do they get their partner treated? What I wanted to do in this study is something that's been looked at a lot less, which is sort of the broader picture. What happens to people's partnership patterns and relationship dynamics? I think there's been less research on this, but I think we know that partnership patterns are important predictors of STD risk. So things like numbers of partners, having new partners, and having concurrent partners. So these are partnership patterns that really haven't been looked at in terms of what's the impact of a diagnosis on these behaviors. Can people hear me okay? Okay, because I'm not holding the mic. I project. Okay. So we did a study called the Behavioral and Molecular Epidemiology of Repeat Infections. The primary objective of this study was to look at sources of repeat infections. Where are the repeat infections coming from? And that work has been done. A secondary objective was to do what I just talked about, to look at the impact of a diagnosis on partnership patterns. And so that's what I'm going to present to you today. So we did a cohort study. We enrolled young women in a family planning clinic who had chlamydia, and we followed them for 4 months. The data were collected between 2005 and 2008. We did an interview using computer technology. And our final sample size for this analysis is 188 women, which was 79% of the women we enrolled. So our analysis, we compared the 4 month time period before the chlamydia diagnosis, this is the baseline period, and the 4 month time period after the diagnosis, so this was the follow-up period. And we looked at numbers of reported sex partners, having partners of short duration, in other words, new partners, and concurrency. So we compared these measures in the baseline period and the follow-up period to see if it was different after the diagnosis of chlamydia. So briefly, our sample, the mean age of the women was 20. It was a racially and ethnically diverse population. And their level of risk is reflected in a mean age of first intercourse of 15 and a half years. The median number of lifetime sex partners was 5. And 43% of the sample had had a previous diagnosis of an STI. Mostly chlamydia. So this is sort of the standard analysis that you typically see, sort of what happens in relationships. So the 188 women reported 264 partners in the baseline. This is the 4 months before the diagnosis. 40% of those relationships continued after the diagnosis. 60% of them ended. In the relationships that continued, 75% reported knowing that her partner got treated. 45% of the ended relationships, the partner was treated. And in addition to the continued partners, 73 women, or 39% of the sample, also reported new sex partners in the follow-up period. So this is sort of, you know, what we see. Again, I wanted to look more at the pattern. So what happens to numbers of sex partners after the diagnosis? So in the baseline period, these women reported 264 partners. In the follow-up period, there were 202 sex partners reported. So number of sex partners went down. And you can see that in the bar graph distribution, where at baseline, the number of partners is skewed to the right, so higher numbers of partners. And at follow-up, the distribution is skewed more to the left, where there are fewer sex partners. And this was a significant decline in the number of sex partners in the follow-up period. I also looked at this, I dichotomized that variable just to for simplicity and to be consistent with some of my other measures. And you can see that in the baseline period, 33% of the girls had multiple partners, and this was reduced to 15% in the follow-up period. So numbers of partners appeared to go down. We also looked at partnerships of short duration. I define this somewhat arbitrarily as 3 months or less. So these are new partners. In the baseline period, before the diagnosis, 44% of the sample reported having a new partner. And at follow-up, that was reduced to 28%. And again, this is a significant decline. So fewer new partners in the follow-up period after the chlamydia diagnosis. Our third measure was concurrency. We compared this pre and post. And this did not change. Unlike the other two measures, the number of women reporting being in concurrent sex partnerships at baseline was 21%, and this was 18% in the follow-up period, and this difference was not statistically significant. So we wanted to look a little bit at correlates of these changes, and you know, given our sample size of 188, and given that we have three outcomes, we wanted to pick our correlates judiciously, so I picked two. I picked age and history of an STI. These are two well-established risk factors for STIs. And we looked to see if there were any differences between these groups in these changes in partnership patterns. And maybe it's easier to look at the graph on the right. So at baseline, you can see the blue line is the older women, and the orange line is the younger women, and then what you see basically is a decline in the number of partners, which I already showed, but happening for both the women over 20 and the women under 20. So similar declines. And the same thing for previous STI. So the declines that we see in numbers of sex partners seem to happen equally for the younger women and the older women and for those with and without a previous STI. I also wanted to look at whether or not baseline number of sex partners was associated with follow-up number of sex partners, and in fact it was. That's the p-value of 0.03. So 24% of the women with multiple partners at baseline had multiple partners at follow-up, compared to only 11% of the women who had a single partner at baseline. So age and STI history did not predict this decline, but baseline number of partners did. Similarly, for having new partners or partnerships of short duration, again, you can see looking at the graph, the same thing. The decline that we saw overall in having new partners between baseline and follow-up happened similarly for the younger women and the older women, and happened similarly also for whether or not the woman had a previous STI. So that was not a significant correlate. But we, again, compared at baseline having a short partnership to having a short partnership at follow-up, and those were statistically significantly associated at 0.04. And finally, for concurrency, my last result slide. So here again, it's a little bit more mixed. We did not see an overall improvement in concurrency or decline in concurrency between baseline and follow-up. And you can see the graphs on the right kind of show that. So the older women did reduce their concurrency, that blue line on the top graph, but the younger women did not. And similarly for STI history, women who had a previous STI history did reduce concurrency in the follow-up, but those without an STI history did not. So it's more mixed. We're not seeing the declines in concurrency like we are for the other measures. Again, we looked at baseline concurrency as a predictor of follow-up concurrency, and in fact, they were highly significantly associated. So in conclusion, I think the good news is that we do see declines in overall numbers of sex partners and having new partners after a chlamydia diagnosis. We don't know if these changes are short-lived or how long these changes last, because we only did a four-month follow-up period. So whether or not these reductions in new partners and reductions in numbers of partners is a sustained change, we don't know. More troubling is that concurrency was not reduced at follow-up. I think, you know, some of the counseling messages are use condoms, reduce partners, get tested. I don't know how much reducing concurrency is part of a counseling message, and maybe this is something that could be worked on. Age and STI history did not predict these changes in behaviors, but certainly past behavior was strongly associated with the current behavior. And this is not a new finding. We see that a lot in STI research, but I think we showed it very strongly. So possibly at the time of the initial diagnosis, if you can view that as a window of opportunity for prevention counseling, the women who have higher numbers of partners and concurrent partnerships, those are the ones most likely to continue those behaviors. So that's another potential target for counseling. So my final slide, I just want to bring it back to the session, which is the birds and the bees and what else is driving STDs. And so I would just like to suggest that we need to continue to think about chains of affection. And that is language that is not my own. I borrowed it from Bierman, Moody, and Stovall, who did this analysis with the adolescent health data. And this is a sexual network of adolescents from high school, and you can see that large network on the left. The picture on the right shows that same network, but with temporality overlaid in it, okay, showing that paths of transmission of sexually transmitted infections depend on the temporality of relationships, and you can see they're very complicated. So my recommendation is a broad one, which is just that we, you know, as we struggle to reduce the burden of repeat chlamydia, I think that counseling is important, I think partner treatment is important, but I think that really making an impact is going to require a broader thinking of the context and the risks in which infections are continued to be transmitted, and that this is really all embedded in these very complicated networks. So that's it. I'll end there. Okay.
Very interesting talk. Any comments or questions? I knew Dr. Hogben. We had
Matthew Hogben from CDC. Did you have a chance to ask anything about the nature of the relationships in that sort of main casual kind of aspects? That's a short part, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I can say more, but I thought there was more to your question.
Yeah, I'm thinking about why the partnership, the reduced number of partnerships could have occurred for different sorts of reasons, right? And if you had sort of like a main effect for main partners sort of breaking up some of those over the course of the infection, that would sort of account for the overall loss. But if you've got people who say, it's unlucky that you got chlamydia for it, but I might like an extra casual partner for it. Mm-hmm. That would sort of explain why you don't get so much of a decrement in concurrency. It may not be the casual partners drifting away. It may be the main partners drifting away.
Right.
So that's sort of trying to figure out what the narrative is.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question and a lot to think about. And we do have a lot of questions in this study about the nature of relationships, a lot more than just is it main, is it casual. We have a lot of partnership questions. And we do know that the casual partnerships are the ones that are more likely to end, and the main partnerships are the ones that are more likely to continue. So casual partnerships ending is, you know, possibly a good thing. The main partnerships continuing is definitely a good thing so long as the partner gets adequately treated. Okay, so a partnership that continues where the partner's not treated is not going to be good for ongoing transmission. So I didn't look at that in this particular analysis, but we certainly could. But again, I feel like a lot of that's been reported in the literature, and this was more looking. But what would be interesting would be to look and see if the nature of the partnerships change. So are the partnerships at follow-up, are they more main partnerships, stable partnerships, more committed partnerships? And that would actually be very interesting, and that would sort of be my hope.
So I have a question. If there's a high rate of repeat infections and you see this reduction in behavior, what do you think accounts for that repeat infection? You don't have the data for that, but what would you think?
Well, I think part of it is, I'll show you, is this. Okay, so partner treatment remains inadequate.
Okay.
So in the partnerships that continued, only 75% reported partner treatment, and that's good. I mean, 75%, that's a fairly typical estimate. But that, what about the 25% of partners who aren't treated?
So they're continuing more with their main partner, mm-hmm. and they're mm-hmm. more likely to mm-hmm. not, the partners are not getting treated, so we should focus in getting main partners treated.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Great. Are there any other questions?
And oh, I should say that expedited partner therapy just passed, is now legal in Connecticut as of October 2011. So we can maybe do a better job of treating partners now that clinicians can actually do it.
Hi, Mary Jo Mulliners from Minneapolis Public Health Clinic. Just curious, and I'm sorry if I missed this, how many of the young women were mothers?
You didn't miss it. I didn't say it. I actually, I don't think any were, but I would have to actually go and check that, because we did collect that, and we've never looked at that variable, and we've been looking at these data for a while, so it makes me think that none of them were.
Because I think that's a big factor.
We do know, we do see in this population, like we see in a lot of other populations, sort of that baby daddy phenomenon where the women who are mothers have sex with the father of their baby, but she's in a relationship with another person. So we do see that, but I haven't quantified that in this, but we could.
This will be the last question. Sorry, we're kind of.
I saw that you broke it down in certain ways, but did you break it down, the results, by race as well?
No.
Didn't.
No, we could, and I'd be happy to look at that and share it with you. I didn't want to sort of overanalyze the data given the sample size that we had, and I tried to keep the analysis focused. But
great, thank you so much.
Sure.
Excellent.